This is Snobs on Film.
A couple of guys I used to work with in the department took some money from some drug dealers. No big deal.
They stole?
They liberated funds.
Theft is theft. There's no gray area.
Hey, Massa, New York is one big gray area, okay?
Did you take money?
Yeah, I took money. I'm not proud of it, okay? You know, I had a divorce, got kids, bills.
Did Charisan know? He was a policeman, Nick. If you steal, you disgrace him. And yourself. And me.
All right, strap in, babe. Here we go. Snobs on Film. My name is Arthur. I am joined with Isaac, Ayiko, and Jahan, and this is the season 2 finale of Snobs on Film. Redemption, where film by film we go through, drill into the redemptive story arcs of the characters in these films. This is the one. This is 1989's 89?
Yeah.
Another summer.
Right. This is the one. Ridley Scott's 1989 film Black Rain, starring Michael Douglas. When Michael Douglas was just at his apex. Of mid, late 80s into 90s star power. This man was coming off of what? Romancing the Stone, Fatal Attraction. Had he done the joint with Demi Moore yet? The one where the sexual harassment?
No.
That was later, late. Right?
But the film that he came off, like straight off came off, was Wall Street winning an Oscar.
Right! Wall Street! Gecko!
When was Basic Instinct? That was after this. That was 90, right?
92.
92. Okay.
Ooh, Michael Douglas was on fire, boy. All right. Let me give you a synopsis of this film. Black Rain. Can a man find redemption even when he's not searching for it? Michael Douglas is Nick Conklin, a New York City cop whose past crimes have nearly caught up to him. But when a Japanese mobster makes a bold move in New York, Nick and his partner, played endearingly, man, that's the word, boy. Endearingly enough by Andy Garcia, at his best. They become outsiders in Tokyo, trying to find their way into a world that's struggling with its own identity. Soon, the stakes are higher than anyone anticipated, and Nick is suddenly forced to choose between the satisfaction of revenge and the honor of redemption. Now, let's get right to it. And Isaac is bursting, so let's just get right to it. What is the core circumstance or conflict that necessitates redemption in Black Rain, and which characters does it involve?
First of all, this movie is great. It's great. Fantastic. All right, now back to what Arthur was saying.
I mean, we gave it away in the synopsis, but I mean, clearly Nick is walking a redemptive path.
This is Nick. This is not, I mean, listen, throughout this season, we've done a lot of films where it's like, it could be this, it could be that. Maybe it's these people, maybe it's the entire world, so on and so forth. I think in this film, it's Nick. It's not, there's no gray areas, whatever.
Hey man, New York City is one big gray area.
Right. Hey, great line. I don't care what you say. That's a great line. Great 80s line. That's what the thing, man. It's like, because as you know, John was texting saying he was laughing at a lot of these lines, laughing lovingly at a lot of these lines in this movie. But one thing you have to remember, this was the 80s, and you could get away with a line like that in the movie. It's a parody now that we do on those type of lines. But back in the 80s, New York is one big gray area. That's a great line. That's a great line. That's Oscar worthy, Jahan. Somebody got an Oscar behind that, probably.
But listen, now Nick's got his own issues before we even get
right,
to
it's hinted
Japanese
at the beginning. He's accused of taking money at the beginning of the film. We find out in a brilliant way, in my opinion, we find out in the middle of the movie that he actually did take the money. And I think the way they reveal that was great. But it's clear that this is a person who definitely needs redemption. What's interesting to me, though, is that, like we hinted at in the cold open or in the synopsis, he doesn't necessarily seek it. and I'll get to it to that later when I think he actually does seek it. I think it's a brilliant scene. But he's not, for most of the movie, he's not out here like, I need to redeem myself. He feels like he didn't do anything wrong. He feels like circumstances, right. You know, circumstances kind of forced him to do what he did, and it's okay. They were just drug dealers. I took some money. So what? My kids got mm-hmm. private school. I'm divorced, mm-hmm. you know, all mm-hmm. these things. Mm-hmm. I got a mm-hmm. cool ass loft apartment that looks out mm-hmm. on the bridge, you know, mm-hmm. all these things. So I don't know how you guys feel, but for me, clearly it was Nick.
Yeah.
I think it was Nick too. I do feel that it was, there's a small redemptive arc for Matsumoto in that he is really against his wishes needing to be paired with Conklin and Garcia when they're in Tokyo to find Sato, who was introduced in New York City. He's really the literally and figuratively the trigger for this film to jump off when he openly assassinates two Japanese rivals who are at a restaurant having lunch with no mafioso, and Conklin and Vincent Andy Garcia's character are both in this restaurant as well, you know, just on their own business. I do like 80s arrogant white man, it's not my fault, even though I broke everything in the room and caused everyone's lives to implode. I was right all along. But I had some real problems with this film, and I think a lot of it is influenced by, you know, the fact that I'm an adult and all this hindsight and all this, that, and the other. But, you know, I really found a distaste for Michael Douglas. Maybe it would have been better if it was Bruce Willis in the lead role, but Michael Douglas being the one who, you know, has total disregard for any kind of proper pronunciation of Japanese names, even after being repeatedly corrected.
He's racist.
He's racist. You know, he nothing's his fault, and it just kind of left a bit of a distaste for me. Like, at no point did I ever want to root for his character.
Well, that's because there's no character development. He has none. It's just, you know, him and his white mediocrity, and the fact that he's managed to float this whole film when the true star of the film gets murked. So yeah, he sucks. Sorry, Isaac.
I agree. Yeah, I agree completely that for me, in watching this, and it had been some years, you know, I've loved this movie since I saw this movie. I went to the theater and saw this movie in 89, not knowing what the hell it was about. It was just,
oh, wow.
This was okay. A time period, you know, I don't know how, you can't really, well, we can't go to any theaters now, but back, you know, it's hard to go to the movies in this era without knowing what the hell the movie is about. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to go in cold unless you put your head in, you know, you bury your head in the sand. But it was just a Saturday, I think, and I was with a friend. I was like, yo, let's go check this out. It was 89. I was very young. I don't even know if I was supposed to be in there. But this was I'm sure this movie was rated R. But anyway, went to go see this movie, not knowing what it's about. I've loved this movie ever since. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I've never liked Conklin. I've never rooted for him for the same reasons you guys said. He just, mm-hmm. he's never, you know. Tony Soprano is a classic anti-hero where he's a racist, he's a murderer, he's this and that, but you root for Tony. You know what I'm saying? You like Tony. He's endearing, right. To use one of the terms we use in the synopsis. But Conklin is not endearing. You don't like him. Mm-hmm. I didn't even root for him at the end, you know. But I like the film, and I think that it works. I think Michael Douglas works in this role better because, again, he never seeks redemption. He never rises out of his mediocrity. He's the classic, you know, rule, like Arthur said, the rule breaking white man 80s cop. Even Bruce Willis was that in Die Hard. You know what I'm saying? He's the rule breaker who everything works out at the end. But I like the film for the undercurrents. And I picked up on them when I was younger. I particularly picked up on them, of course, as I'm older, but I like the undercurrents and the redemption, the forced redemption onto Michael Douglas's character in the face of revenge. He has the chance at revenge, not just because he could have killed Sato, which we'll talk about later, but also because there's a conversation that I'll get to later that changes everything for him in a very subtle way. And I think the way it was handled, it just tips the scale a little bit from revenge to redemption, and it's all tied up in the ideas of honor that Japan, in particular, the old guard is struggling with in regard to the new guard of Sato's character. And all these things are kind of interwoven, and suddenly there's a reckoning that's going on that we're aware of between the old and the new. And then it gets tied up in the redemptive arc of this media, as Aiko said, this mediocre character. And it all becomes very fascinating to me. The only person I really liked in the film, to be honest, was two people, was Matsumoto and Charlie. More so Matsumoto.
Now, I want to say, to provide a little context for the conversation, is that Conklin is a good detective.
Yes.
And so it's not like he's a hack and needs to fake it until he makes it. He's actually the one who exposes for the Japanese police superintendent and Matsumoto how the Yakuza mob is counterfeiting American currency. And he also figures out on his own, with the help of Cape Capshaw's character, some
Joyce.
Random blonde woman in a sea of, I mean, it's like, if you want to find a needle in a haystack, he finds it at this one club where she just happens to be there on that night. But Conklin puts all the pieces together. You know, he understands why Sato as a
Sato.
Young...
as they get corrected many times in the film, it's Sato, Arthur. Sato. If you can do Yakuza, if you can do Yasuke, then you can do Sato.
And Sato doesn't want to, no. But okay, just basically the bottom line is Conklin is a good detective. He's a good cop, but he's a terrible guest, to say the least. And Andy Garcia as his partner, Charlie Vincent, is a real balance, or at least tries to be a buffer throughout all of his screen time, tries to be a buffer between Charlie and the entirety of the Japanese police through Matsumoto as a proxy, to be able that they can find Sato, bring him to justice, and then basically they can go home.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he knows how the game is played as well. Like, even in New York, when Douglas has got to go and speak to internal affairs, Garcia recommends that he wears his uniform. You know, put your best foot forward.
Yeah, Charlie's basically Conklin's handler.
Yeah. Well, Charlie's vibe to me is mostly not so much that he's a goody two shoes or that he's such a moral
conscious.
He's
looking out for his boy, right, as well.
Yeah, that's part of it. But also is that Charlie just wants everything to be cool so he can have a good time. And he's like, yo, man, stop rocking the boat. We chill, you know, like later on at the Tokyo Club, he's like, is your whole agenda to fuck up my evening? Remember, he says that to him because he's like, why don't you guys just make up? We got 5-6 beautiful women here. Why don't y'all make up so we can, you know, we drinking, we eating, we about to go sing, you know, it's like, what are y'all tripping on? And it's like, I think that's...
Yeah, even on the plane when they dock.
Even on the plane.
Talking to the flight attendants, trying to get them to go to the hotel, etc.
Charlie just wants to have a good time.
This is just so funny. It's like this movie, and full disclosure, when I watched this film, it was the first time that I'd ever seen it.
Yeah, same here.
So I was coming in completely fresh. And I'm telling you, this was just like a serious crime version of Rush Hour to me. And Charlie was the Chris Tucker character of like, you know, look, I'm high, I'm home. I just want to, you know, I'm in Japan. I ain't got nothing to do. We here for 2 weeks, baby. I'm just ready to rock, you know. But Conklin's, you know, effing it all up. He's the bull that's breaking everything in, you know, in the... Oh God, that's a terrible analogy in the China shop.
I saw it coming.
Damn. Yeah.
I thought, how's he gonna get out of this one?
Let me rephrase.
Censors at the ready.
Conklin is the one that's just coming in and just tearing everything up, you know, in the name of, I need my questions answered. I need to bring in this guy as a way to show, basically, to get internal affairs off my back. Like, if I can get Sato back to New York, if I can be the one that bags him, then I can get all this heat off of me.
I didn't feel that from him.
Oh no, Arthur, I think you're 100% right.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think that setting aside Douglas's problems in New York, and the accusations that he's been skimming off of drug busts. There's a moment, there's a scene where he shares with Charlie or Ken Takakura's character, Matsumoto, mm-hmm. that his superiors feel that he may have been paid mm. to let Sato go.
Mm.
So mm-hmm. so he knows that nailing Sato proves that theory yeah. wrong.
I mean, I don't want to, I mean, not to to dismiss you guys' theory or your thought on it, because I mean, that's, I think it's valid what you guys are saying. Mm-hmm. I didn't get that vibe from him though. I got the vibe from him that I don't give a damn about these internal affairs. You know, it's almost like Aiko said, it's that superiority of, you know, that white male superiority and arrogance where he was just like, these little, you know, that bullshit they talking about, I got, there's 30 homicides a week. I got, you know, cases backed up. You guys are going to pull me in here, hassle me about some, you know, taking somebody mm-hmm. from drug dealers. Get the fuck mm-hmm. out of here with that. You know, now mm-hmm. I got a Japanese mm-hmm. mobster committed a crime in my city. He's like, the U.S., the embassy can have him after he does 20 to 5 here. So I mm-hmm. felt him mm-hmm. following Sato and the whole, especially before Charlie's death, the whole kind of animosity between him and Sato was just built on Nick feeling like, you did this in my city.
Exactly.
And I'm, you know, and I saw it. You belong to me. I'm going to handle this.
Mm, mm-hmm. I think that's the start of it, but not the end of it. And even if it were, which I don't think it is, but even if it were, that's the how, not the why. Like, agreed, in the beginning, he's very much that my call and my case kind of guy, right?
Yeah, he's prideful.
I think once it becomes clear that he's accused of being in cahoots with this gangster, and ostensibly he doesn't have a career when he gets back to New York unless he can nail this guy, then I think that's very much why he chooses to pursue Sato.
I think the reason...
But that's the how, that's not the why. Because he could have pursued it in a much more productive or constructive way, a much more conciliatory way. As Matsumoto says to him, try to think more of your group than yourself.
Right.
Try to work more like a Japanese. You know, you don't have to be this cowboy, literally and figuratively,
right.
you know, running around on your own, dominating everything in sight. You can be more constructive than that.
Mm-hmm.
You can be more effective when you work as a group. To which Douglas's character kind of counters, no, to catch a guy like Sato, you have to work outside your rules because he's not playing within your rules. You know, from Douglas's perspective, mm-hmm. their rules are too rigid for a mm-hmm. guy like Sato.
I think that if it were more so, in my opinion, if it was about him wanting to make sure or prove that he wasn't in cahoots with Sato, I think in this type of film, they would have played that up more. Mm. It really is, and it actually literally is just one line that it gets mentioned, and they never come back to it. I think what happens, I agree with you that there's a shift in his motivations, but I think that's Charlie's death. Right. And I think prior to Charlie's death, it's about, you know, yeah, because I'm going to get this guy because he committed this crime in my city. I don't give a fuck about the embassy or the Japanese mm-hmm. authorities, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After Charlie's death, he killed Charlie. And then there's another shift that we'll talk about later. There's another shift that occurs. But I think those are for Douglas's, for Conklin, and ostensibly at the surface of his mind, those are the reasons.
Let me ask a question. I kind of want to ask directly to Aiko, but for the floor, when Conklin is basically put on an airplane to go home, there's a scene where he's sitting on the airplane, people are getting on, you know, he's just boarded, and he looks out the window and he sees Charlie's casket mm. being loaded into the hull of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the motivation for him to, or at least that's the trigger for him to decide, I'm going to get off of this plane.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, do you think that it was, I need to follow Masumoto's advice, I need to work as a group to avenge Charlie's death, or is it just more of a reminder of, I can't go home with no Sato, Charlie dead, and you all thinking that, you know, I stole this money in Japan as well as in the U.S. I think there was some selfish motivation for Nick to get off of the plane because there was just way too much that he would have to deal with once he got to New York.
Hmm.
I think it was more the latter.
Yeah, same.
First of all, got over, killed my friend, all this other stuff. So yeah, I don't think he cared about it being communal and working with the system or anything like that. I think he, you know, like you said, the motivation changed. So I think he definitely wanted to, you know, get dude. He's been basically chasing this dude the whole entire film and never able to just to get him. So yeah. And then you see your, you know, dead homie's body and it's just like, really, you about to leave or am I going to go handle this? Because I don't think he cared about any rules or anything like that. I really don't. And I think it was all still selfish motivations.
Let me devil's advocate just because I fundamentally I agree with you, but let me just devil's advocate just to keep it interesting for Nick for a second. I think part of the charm of this movie for me is that, and this is storytelling period, but a lot of times for films like these, for you to do something, you have to, or for it to be convincing, you know, you have to believe in it yourself. You have to go all in on it. That's part of the requirement. And they really go all in to the point where some of the lines that like Jay was laughing at and that I kind of secretly was laughing at, they believe in it so much that I accept it. It's cool, you know, and this world that they immerse you in, it's like Ridley Scott, the way he, you know, there's elements of some of his other films in the 80s, you know, there's some Blade Runner, there's definitely some Blade Runner elements in there. I could even see either Ridley Scott's influence on Michael Mann or Michael Mann's influence on Ridley Scott. One of those things. I could see it. I could feel it in some.
I mean,
of
you
these,
were talking about a movie with some dry ice in it. God damn,
dry ice and the way the camera pans. And I fucking loved every minute of that shit.
It's atmospheric. It's very, very atmospheric. It's very time period.
I loved it. And so the music, this was when Hans Zimmer was actually doing, like he was doing it. You know what I'm saying? That last scene where Conklin brings Sato in and the music ramps up, I was like, oh, I was feeling it. I was loving it. Anyway, I think part of just the devil's advocate for Conklin in that moment on the plane, one of the standard things of hero movies like this, any hero movie, is that they don't give up. You don't give up until the job is done. And so I agree with you guys, but just let's let in the possibility that it wasn't so much selfishness. It's so much of the job is not done. Yeah, my partner's dead. I'm going. Everything is fucked up. But I got to get off of this plane. They've escorted me onto the plane. They're standing right over there. There's no really way off of this plane. Oh, wait a minute. I can just go down with the service tray. I don't even know if those things are big enough to fit a full grown man in, but he fit himself in there and got. So just to kind of, you know, again, if I'm going to buy into this world, that's the diehard, you know, John McClane mentality of until the job is done, I'm going to keep doing shit. You know, Eddie Murphy and Beverly Hills Cop, he did it like 20 times in that movie. It was like, get your ass in your car, go back to Detroit. No. The job is not done. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going to find a way. So I agree with you guys. There is some selfishness in there, but I do think that's a part of, if you're going to buy into these type of stories, you have to buy into the fact that the hero just isn't going to stop until the job's done.
So moving into my next question, I mean, like, what stands in the way between Conklin and redemption?
Himself.
Conklin, right?
Yeah.
Nobody seems to disagree with that.
Go ahead, Aiko.
He don't give a fuck about nobody or anything except for, I mean, obviously, you know, they show him caring about his family and so forth. But Conklin, he's in his own way at every single step of the way. He's in his own way. He's arrogant. He's egotistical. He's prideful. You can't tell him shit. How dare you question me? You know, you get him over in Japan, he can't even pretend to act like he's in somebody else's country and have a little respect. He can't say somebody's goddamn name correctly, no matter how many times they ask him, yo, this man's name is Sato. And what does he do? Like, he's the problem. Every single step of the way, he's the problem. So much that even at the end, like, it's not until the last 15 seconds, what, 20 seconds of the film, where they finally get his ass to bow, that, like, you know what I mean? Like, he's the problem every single step of the way. But what I did like about it, because I don't like this film, but what I did like about it is that, like, you know, when Matsumoto kind of checked him, like, he was like, oh, so you not only dishonored yourself, but you dishonored your partner. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like that. And to see that revelation on his face for a second, where he's just like, start to question his own behavior. Yeah, he started to finally, you know, allow room to question his own behavior as opposed to it being everybody else is the problem, not me.
And he's honest for the first time in the movie.
Yeah, but he's the fucking problem the whole time. Him and the crusty ass fucking lips that I don't understand from start to finish. Nobody offered him Carmex, nothing. Thin ass, crusty lips. Look at it again, Isaac. His lips are crusty the whole entire time.
I admit I was not paying too much.
Look at that man's lips. Michael they Douglas's are crusty, lips. They are cracked, and they look like he's been kissing flour. I don't understand how a top actor. Come
on. It was the 80s.
That had nothing to do with the 80s. Eddie Murphy had mad moisturized lips. No. Fucking crusty. Okay.
Jay, what do you think? What was Ayaka right? Was it strictly Conklin? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. He's the hurdle to his own redemption. You know, he's a thief. Mm-hmm. He's a liar. He's obstinate, and you know, he's wrong and strong. He won't hear what anybody else tells him, and he doesn't care. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, now might be a good time to ask: is he redeemed? Like, is he even redeemable in this film? Throughout the season, we've had conversations on whether somebody's motivation affects their redemption.
Yeah.
So why is he doing it here? Is he doing it to avenge Charlie's death? Is he doing it to beat the guy who beat him? Or is he doing it just because this is the stuff he likes to do? He likes to catch bad guys. That's what he does.
Mm.
So I don't know if it's more that than mm-hmm. a come to Jesus moment where he acknowledges and accepts, I have been doing this wrong. Because his methods are still, you know, way out there.
Well, I would...
To answer your question, Isaac, I think for Douglas's character to be redeemed, he would need to change both the how and the why.
I believe that he actually does that. I believe that there is a sliver of redemption, of redemption awareness.
Right.
In the scene where Conklin and Sato are fighting, and he finally has Sato in a position where he can drive his body into a wooden stake. And there's a jump cut to him and Masamoto escorting Sato into the police station. So in other words, old regular Conklin would have killed him. That would have been the revenge moment. That would have been, I got you, now I'm going to kill you because you killed Charlie Vincent, my partner. But instead, he thinks of the group, and by him and Masamoto marching Sato into the police department, Conklin has helped to redeem him, his own self, as well as Masamoto, who was suspended by the police inspector. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that Charlie, that, I keep calling him Charlie. I do believe that Conklin recognized that this is my shot.
Yeah. And you keep calling him Charlie because Charlie's the best character in the movie, should have been built on Charlie.
So I think I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying, but I think that in watching this film, if you think that, if you walk away from it thinking that it was strictly about Nick and his arc and his redemptive arc and so on and so forth, I think you miss out on a large portion of this movie. And there's two really key moments that speak to the broader themes of the film. And I think you guys have already touched on one, and it is mostly dealing just with Nick. Mm-hmm. But it's dealing with, you know, culture as a whole.
And honor, yeah.
And that is absolutely the conversation between Matsumoto and Nick, you know, when they're doing the stakeout. And I think that in the practice of meditation, as you guys know, one of the things that they preach is that think about, you know, why you're doing the practice. It's not just for you. Thinking about how it will benefit, you know, people mm-hmm. in your life. Which is an interesting, you know, concept to think that, okay, this moment that I'm taking for myself mm-hmm. and finding calmness and clarity within my mind and my body, how mm-hmm. is that going to affect other people that I care for or that I deal with, you know? And so in thinking about that, and I kind of connected that back to what was going on in that conversation between Matsumoto and Nick. Matsumoto is really coming at him from a cultural point of view, of course, you know, saying, right. You need to be more Japanese, you know, mm-hmm. and think about when you do this, it brings dishonor upon Charlie, disgrace, I think is the term he mm-hmm. used, against Charlie, your family, your friend. And of course, it's a way of thinking that I think is alien to a lot of Westerners.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that we as Westerners think about a lot, you know. So him putting that on Nick was the moment, in my opinion, for the first time where Nick saw what he was doing in that moment, not just in mm-hmm. the past, but in the actual mm-hmm. moment, what he was mm-hmm. doing and how he was doing it, to John's point, how is that going to affect Charlie's memory? How is that going to affect Matsumoto? How is that going to affect my kids, you know, my ex-wife, my captain, you know, all these people who are orbiting around me? That was a key moment for Nick. And I think that led to Arthur, which you talk about at the end, where he made the choice between mm-hmm. revenge and redemption. There's an honor. Honor was taught to him, you know, at that point. Mm. But within that conversation, and this is, I'll get to this, this brings me to the second conversation, which I thought was very key. There's this push and pull and this knocking of heads, this cultural thing that's going on in Japan at that moment, the old guard and the new guard. Arthur and I were talking recently on Mad Unreal about Yasuke, the anime on Netflix. And a lot of that, the first couple episodes of that anime are dealing with this idea of Japan transitioning and what that means for its culture. You know, and back then in 15, whatever that was, the problem was that these warlords were allowing outsiders in and how it was influencing the culture. Fast forward to, you know, 400 years later and World War II, post-World War II, America has bombed Japan. America has dominated Japan. America has put Japan in the role of being almost like a junior partner. And mm-hmm. now Japan culturally is having Western cultures kind of like leaning on, pushing against his neck, really. So the second conversation that was very key was between, in my opinion, was between Nick and Suke, the crime lord. Oh, and the yeah. crime lord details to him, when I was a child, when I was 10 years old, and the bombs came, and he's talking about the bombing of the two cities in Japan where hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. He says, you know, the world burned. The world burned. You know, we lived underground for 3 days. And you made the rain black. Mm-hmm. You know, he tells Nick this, you meaning, you know, the Americans. And so when he's explaining this, Nick, he's talking to him about, after that, you started shoving your values down our throat. Mm-hmm. And that's what created Sato and thousands mm-hmm. of others just mm-hmm. like him. So mm-hmm. you get that there's this war, this cultural war going on in Japan. And you see it in mm-hmm. Matsumoto, too, because Matsumoto mm-hmm. is like, well, the soldiers, you know, after the war, they had honor. He's talking about on an individual level, the American mm-hmm. soldiers. Mm-hmm. Suge is talking about the empire, you know, and what it did to my country and then mm-hmm. what it did culturally to my country. And so to me, that was the moment when it was like, you see this idea of honor and what that means from the old view. And then you see how it's being deteriorated in the new world. And this individuality mm-hmm. that's grown up. It's the opposite of the meditative theory. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you know, you don't meditate just for yourself. You meditate for just for those around you as well. Well, in this world, this new world, it's about you. Sato mm-hmm. is about self. Mm-hmm. You know, Sato mm-hmm. is about himself. And in Suge's eyes, you created Sato, you know. And so the Black Rain thing comes in there. It's almost as if the Black Rain separated the old world from the new world. Nick is firmly a part of the new world. But he has a chance to make one decision, which he does, that would show an old world value system,
right?
Choosing honor, choosing redemption, choosing Charlie's memory over my need, my satisfaction of revenge. Let me honor Charlie. And he does that. And that's why, all jokes aside, it was emotional, I thought, when that moment when he walks in with Sato, because it was like he chose Charlie's memory. You know, he chose to honor his friends and his family. He chose to do the old way. Prior to the Black Rain. After the Black Rain, Arthur, you're right, Nick would have just killed him, but he chose to go back before the Black Rain to Suge, and I don't think he heard what everything Suge was saying, because he essentially, at that moment, as a quick aside, he hired himself out as an assassin for a crime lord, by the way. But part of Suge's point was that before the Black Rain, things were different. Now, after the Black Rain, we're in this world. And for that moment, when Nick walks in with Sato at the end, it was pre-Black Rain. And I thought it was beautiful.
Damn, you broke that all the way down, babe.
You need to tell the audience why we're using babe. We're using babe, y'all, because that's out the film. It's like everybody calls each other babe and it's hilarious.
Is Suge the only character in the entire movie who Douglas is respectful of?
Yes.
You know, he calls him Suge-san. Yes. So Suge-san... I'm the solution to all your problems. And Suge's like, he's like, get out of here, you idiot. But he persists. He sits down and he says, Suge-san, I'm the solution to all your problems. It shows that he knows how to do it when he wants to.
Yeah, I think he is respectful to him, but also because of the time. That's later in the film when Douglas has had time to kind of ruminate on all these things. And then also he's in a position where, one, he desperately needs Suge's help. And then two, he knows that Suge could have him killed at any moment. You know, by mm-hmm. that big dude who dangled on. Great scene, by the way.
And
the golf
I know,
scene.
And I thought too, I said, man, Conklin, you really might not want to
be yourself.
Be dealing with this dude with your back to basically the cliff.
Boxing
and dude
your
sure
weight.
Did just lean him out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had shades of, it reminded me a little bit. There's a great scene in The Insider. When Michael Mann's The Insider, when Russell Crowe's golfing and the guy just comes and looks at him. You remember that, Jay? He's golfing at a very similar thing to where Suge was golfing at. I got kind of like echoes of that. Well, actually, this movie preceded that. So Michael Mann kind of paid homage to that. But I think, though, like, to my point, though, I think, you know, I definitely agree with you guys in terms of who had the obstacles. It was definitely, as far as Nick's obstacles, definitely him. But I think that if you walk away from this film thinking that that was the sole redemptive arc and that all these other things were happening, I think you miss out on a big part of what was happening in this movie. There's a reason it's called Black Rain.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that those themes are interwoven with this. There's a reason why Douglas played this character, I think, so stereotypical, over the top, racist, you know, I'm going to do whatever I want white man. And it plays out, you know, when you see what happens in the rest of the movie thematically.
I just wanted to quickly acknowledge Suge, played by Tomisaburo Wakayama, who was the lone wolf in a series of very famous Japanese samurai films, specifically Shogun Assassin.
Yep.
Mm. He was the lone wolf.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to lay that in, and I will make sure not to conflate Japanese culture with ninjas.
Right, which you do a lot. You do that
Kung Fu
a lot.
And,
I have a question about the beginning, the opening scene. Why, when they were sitting in the bar, if they already had guns and they saw Sato stab old dude, why did they then let him slit dude's throat when they could have easily taken him out with a gun?
Because the other guys had machine guns, and I think they was looking at the civilians.
But they let him kill two people.
So you're both right. You're both right. It's a busy restaurant. It's a busy scene. Lots of people in the firing line. Douglas notices Garcia going for his gun.
Right.
Don't even think about it, babe. To which Garcia responds,
"Already done, babe.
Already done, babe.
Already done, babe."
But then here's where Aiko, you're right. They are still way too early when they start shooting, because they wait for bad guy number one to get waxed. They wait for bad guy number two to get waxed. And then once the bad guys start to leave the restaurant, they immediately pursue. Bad guys, of course, notice, turn around, fire back into the restaurant. Everybody's firing onto the street, where, of course, there are loads of people in the firing line. Okay. So, yeah, still ridiculously early and ridiculously dangerous.
That's why I'm confused. Okay, so the other question is, because I kept trying to turn on subtitles and I found none. So I was like, is this a plot device in the sense that, like, I never understood what anybody was saying? Like, I'm like, why is Sato cursing dude out? What happened? What did dude mouth off and say to him that made Sato turn around and be like, really? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I couldn't understand anything. And I was like, well, maybe it's a plot device. So it's like, we don't speak a second language, or we don't speak Japanese. So we're sitting here watching this and trying to make sense of everything that's going on. But like, at no time do you really get to hear what the other characters are saying to each other.
So again, it's a yes or no answer. For much of the movie, we don't have the subtitles. For the scene that you're talking about, we see it from Garcia and Douglas's point of view. So they don't speak Japanese, and we understand it as they would understand the scene, just physically.
Right.
But there are, however, subtitles in all the scenes where there are only Japanese speakers in the scenes. So when Sato is talking to Suge, etc., there are subtitles in all those scenes, but only those scenes.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was very effective. And full disclosure, there was sometimes I turned on the closed caption when Matsumoto was just talking English, because I was missing some of, because of his accent, I was missing some of what he was saying. So But in terms of the subtitles, I thought it was very effective for them not to use subtitles at certain times, because it just made, again, it just put us in, you know, Charlie or Nick's place. And it's like, what are these guys saying? Are they talking about me? What are they saying? You know, it's like, and I like the fact that Sato, like at the table, when he's saying those things, it's like that. And the actor, sadly, I just read yesterday when I was researching that he passed away.
He died immediately after.
Did he?
After the film, cancer. The actor Ridley played Scott, Sato.
Ridley Scott dedicated the movie to him.
Yusaku Matsuda. So anyway, though, when he was at the, he did so much. I mean, this dude was Joker level or beyond, you know what I'm saying? He was like so sinister and so demonstrative with just a blink or just the look of his eyes, in his eyes. I thought he was phenomenal. I liked the fact that I didn't need to hear exactly what he was saying at times. He gave me everything. I loved Sato.
Actually, to that end, the scene that you were talking about, Aiko, is very powerful with the absence of subtitle, because once the initial interaction is over and once Sato's finished his initial moment and he's taken the counterfeit plate from that guy's pocket, he turns around and leaves. But just when he's turned around, the guy's henchman says something to him. And we don't know what he says.
He sure did.
And Sato turns around and without actually saying any words, he gives him a, what did you say, kind of vibe. The beauty is that we don't know what the guy said, but everything in Sato's physical manner is like, yo, we're in a bad moment here. Sato turns his body around, raises an eyebrow, and like with a maniacal glare, just kind of emits a, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what the guy said to him, but we just know, dude, whatever it was, you should not have said that.
Right, right. And I don't want to keep going back to the last scene, but when Nick does bring him in and they're both covered with mud, Sato has this grin on his face. It's a really subtle like grin. It's perfect. It's just like, in any other movie, they would have been like, the director or whoever would have been like, you know, you need to look angry. You just got caught. Your whole empire just fell. You know, all your plans are gone, whatever, whatever. No. He walks in and he has this little grin and this triumphant music is playing. And it's like, it was perfect. I loved it. So yeah, Sato is one of my favorite villains, quote unquote villains.
He's actually the most Western out of all the Japanese characters, if you think about it. Like, he's kind of a mirror to Douglas's character. You know, the arrogance, the need to dominate, you know, I got my own way of doing things.
So for clarification, in the film, during the conversation between Sato and Suge?
Suge, yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the film? Yeah.
Yeah, Sato cuts off the tip of his pinky to show allegiance, mm-hmm. right?
Well, to show he has to atone. It's an atonement. Yeah, he has to atone for his past crimes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
In order for
okay.
us to move forward, you have to atone for your past.
Okay.
So have a pinky.
But even still, it was all a part of gaining confidence so that Suge's
confidence.
Well, that was an interesting. Listen, I love this film. It's not perfect, and that was one of the interesting things. That's like a timing question for me. It's like, dude, he knew
the brethren have showed up a bit earlier.
Exactly, he was going to pull a Michael Corleone. You know, he knew that. I'm taking out the heads of all the families. So you got these five. I think they're called Abayuns. I think is what their names were. Basically, the Godfathers. The Godfathers, and he was like, you know, he's going to take all of them out at the same time. That was his plan. So it was all orchestrated, but you kind of think, could they have shown up before he cut off his pinky? But then I'm thinking, if you get in the mind of Sato, he probably didn't mind that. Like, this motherfucker is like, he's committed. Like, he's a little crazy, but he's kind of, like you said, he's kind of like a mirror image of Nick. So it's like, yeah, okay. He probably told his guys, okay, after I cut off my pinky, then you guys come in. It's
like, That's the cue.
One of his guys is probably like, we could come in before you cut off. He's like, no.
And then my thing is, yeah. And then he cuts his pinky off, but he doesn't make a sound.
No.
Oh, no. He's tough, man. That's Sato, man. He's just talking
Suge
about.
Dead in his eye when he does it. Like, you think this means anything to me?
Yeah, he's bad.
Yeah.
And that was, and again, the old ways versus the new. That was definitely the old ways. You know, you don't just say you're sorry. You don't just, as part of the atonement, we go through this ritual. You saw the whole thing was set up. That they had the knife and everything was like made for that, you know. So it was like they brought it over. Suge is from the old ways. He's from the old world. So this is how we do. Pre-Black Reign, this is how we do. And Sato gave into that at that moment as a way to atone for his past crimes and to say, I'm going to abide by the old rules. Now, of course, 30 seconds later, it's like, no, it's a new world. I'm stabbing you and killing you. And, you know, right. I'm taking over your whole empire. But yeah, to your point, I mean, Sato, he probably did tell his boys, yeah, you know, come in after I cut off my finger.
Which is funny because since he didn't make any sound, you know, his boys were like, well, did it happen? Shit, I don't know. I mean,
did you get right. the signal? Right.
Yeah.
I would have ended that film when he brought in Sato.
Yeah.
Like that, to me, that was that should have been the last scene of the movie. That's the only, I think it gets the airport scene. I've always felt, like I said, I love this movie, but I don't think it's perfect. And the airport scene I felt was very much an 80s cliche. You know, especially when he gives the thumbs up and everything. I could have done without all of that. I think that the movie should have ended when he brought in Sato. That was all I needed.
I was good up to the point where the thumb raise happens. I was absolutely fine with them exchanging gifts, Conklin and Masamoto, and Masamoto seeing that the plates were underneath the shirt. To me, that was a little...
Yeah, but what position is Douglas putting his character in?
Exactly, exactly.
Like, the guy's very law-abiding. He's communicated to Douglas's character multiple times. This is my honor. This is my code. These are my principles. Why would Douglas's character disrespect that after everything? Why would he say, I don't care what you've told me. I don't care about your code. Here you go. Start conducting a continuing criminal enterprise of massive scale.
And that's what, and I know we gotta get to the third section, but just really quickly, that's why I feel like that last scene wasn't needed, because I didn't know, was he giving them back to Mats to say, here, I didn't, just to prove to you I didn't steal them, and I know you're going to, because you're code bound, I know you're just going to give them to your captain or whatever,
right?
Or were they implying that Mats, like John said, he's going to go off and start printing money?
No,
which he absolutely is not going to do.
He says, right, he says anyone who has these would be set up
right.
for life.
And that's why I was like, I didn't.
Come on.
Yeah, come that on. That scene.
What's Matsumoto supposed to do? What's he supposed to tell his superiors? Oh, by the way, listen.
I found these.
I didn't steal these, but somehow they miraculously ended up in my possession. What's he supposed to do? Everything puts him in a bad position. And right. under suspicion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, wait, I got another question. Is there any better depiction in 80s cinema of the trope, the likable best friend to the hero who gets killed?
Mm. Goose.
Yeah, I would say I could think of better
Goose
ones
more than
or
Goose.
As good ones.
Goose.
Is Goose more likable than Charlie?
Goose, no. More than Charlie.
He's not more likable.
But Goose is, no, he's not more likable. To me, they're in the same. They're definitely in the same room, but Goose not only understands Maverick, but Goose is actually trying to instruct Maverick on how to have a happy future. He's got his family, you know, singing to his wife. There's a whole thing to it. You know, Vincent knows Conklin's going to be Conklin. I just need to manage this. I just need to manage him.
Vincent knows that the film should have been centered on his character and not Nick's boring ass crusty lip character. Because as soon as
Aiko did not like
I
did
as soon
movie.
As Charlie left the fucking film, like it's like, you know, I don't feel like the film was that strong that it could have, you know, whatever. I feel like Charlie really was, but I think I agree with
And they were not
good.
No, they weren't, and they were letting Conklin know too. You know, your partner, when I killed your partner right in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, when your partner died, when you didn't do nothing for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Jay.
They drove that.
I
point
think home. Jay. Though, to answer your question, though, Jay, I don't know, because I'm like Goose, and you know, I don't know if I've liked anybody more than Charlie. Mm, I think maybe right. I could, if I thought really hard about it, I could find something that I liked as much as Charlie.
Yeah.
But I do think, though, Charlie's death, I remember, because like I said, I saw this movie in the theater.
You feel it.
And I remember.
It's terrible.
I remember the moment when Charlie got killed leading up to that moment, because it's beautifully played out.
It
he
is.
Runs away. Nick is yelling, because Nick is like, you know, it's funny at first. You know, dude stole your jacket, whatever, whatever. That's what you get. Then all of a sudden, Nick realizes there's an element of danger here. And he starts mm-hmm. yelling, Charlie, come back, Charlie, come back. Then mm-hmm. he runs after him. And we see Charlie get lost in this parking garage maze, and those engines of the motorcycle
the
start.
Yeah,
And you get the flashback because you remember when they circled them before, you know, a few scenes, you know, the day earlier or whatever. And for a moment, you think, you know, something's going to happen, but, you know, Charlie going to be all right. You know, maybe they'll rough him up or something. But then there's that moment when you realize, oh, shit, Charlie's going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, it, I remember being first. In theater thinking, I remember, yeah.
Didn't they
I remember
in theater.
But before that, before they stab him, there's just like a moment where the danger becomes really, really real. And Nick realizes it. And he starts yelling, get out of there. You know, because Charlie's from New York. He's just sitting there. He's yelling, yeah, you come over here, motherfucker, fuck with me. You know,
right.
And Nick is like, oh, whoa. This is, get out of there. You know, get out of there. Mm-hmm. And that's when for the audience, you realize, oh, shit, Charlie's going to die. And then they cut him. And you're like, oh.
Didn't they decapitate him?
And he gets beheaded.
Yeah.
They decapitate him. Yeah. And it was. And you know, you get the angle of the sword dragging on the concrete. Yeah. I thought it was really
well done.
You know, it was very well done.
Yeah
very well done. All right, Arthur.
I was a little baffled that it's like after all this time, you all didn't just pick up enough Japanese to get a cab to the hotel.
Right, they're walking everywhere. Right.
That's actually really interesting because we haven't talked about Matsumoto's character arc, and whether his character needs redemption, seeks redemption, gets redemption. But he does say in that moment after Charlie's death, he does say to Douglas's character, I don't think this would have happened if I was with you. That's not an empty thing he's saying. You see that it weighs heavy on him. And I wonder if his decision to kind of go against his whole kind of code and join Douglas's character in the end in this kind of rogue operation, I wonder if that's spurred by that he feels this kind of guilt or shame that Charlie's fate was somehow in his hands too.
Right, like he forms his own little group, his micro group with Conklin. I think there were a few things that were going on with Matsumoto, and Conklin was the catalyst for that. And Conklin was the catalyst for that. One, he was on the outs with his boss. He was on the outs with his colleagues. He was in disfavor with his own son. And
yeah, exactly.
He needed some currency to be able to restore these relationships. And I think he didn't have anything to lose by that point.
Yeah, but less how he feels in relation to his position in the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that he thinks, you know, had I been there, I could have stopped this.
Yeah.
Just point blank.
What was he gonna do?
Put him in a cab to the hotel.
Why does he have to be responsible?
But it's about his character and what he feels. He voices this feeling. I mean, he says it.
Mm-hmm.
If I had been here, I don't think that this would have happened.
Yeah, we remember the scene.
I just think, in my opinion, I don't know if it's so much about Matsumoto thinking he needed to redeem himself in that light. Because I do agree with Jahan as far as. It is more about how he sees it through his lens of how he views himself. Is regardless of what we think, you know, you couldn't have done anything. His probably feeling is like, I should have been there, you know, because, you know, whether or not I could have done anything was, you know, regardless, I should have been there. But I do feel that maybe when we're, again, not to beat a dead horse, but when we're talking about the old ways and the new ways, often it's not necessarily a choosing between one or the two. It's finding some sort of compromise. Mm-hmm. And I think that for Matsumoto, he did find a little bit of compromise or understanding of what Nick was saying as far as you don't go to your superiors. You know, you talk to your partner first. You know, that's outside of Matsumoto's code, because his code is like, motherfucker, I saw you steal the money. You know, I thought you take the money. Right. Uh-huh. So I'm going to tell the superiors. Now, in Nick's view and in Charlie's view, to be fair, because Charlie told him we were going to cut you in on this. Charlie's view is as well saying, if you talked to your partners, you would have found out we didn't steal the money. We were trying to show that the money was counterfeit, which we did, you know. So had you talked to us, you would have learned that. So I think maybe part of Matsumoto's thing is that he learned, he put a lot of his ideology into Nick and forced Nick to deal with that. But I think there was a tad bit of Nick's ideology that influenced Matsumoto at the end. And that's why he showed up.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons he showed up. That's just a theory. I'm not, because I see what Jahan is saying. And I think that may also be part of it. But I think it's kind of a theory that maybe that's also part of what made Matsumoto do what he did.
All right, we're going to tie this off. and do a segment called Say That Again, where we reveal which line of dialogue in Black Rain perfectly captures the focus theme of the film. Who wants to go first?
Or was just hilarious.
I vote for that one.
Well, Isaac, why don't you kick us off, hot dog?
I actually don't have one. I loved every line in this film and did not mock any of them. John, please let us hear your the lines you thought were good.
Yeah, babe.
I mean, good is pushing it. But I think the one that elicited the most laughter from me would have to have been, because he says it in such a momentous, heavyweight way, with a pause. If you pull it, you better be ready to use it.
Love that line. Loved it. You know, I love that line because I've heard that, like, about how many times have we heard that in real life, though? You've heard that in real life a lot of times. So I love that line. The pause is great, though, especially since he's talking about a sword.
A wooden stick.
A wooden stick, whatever it is. If you pull it, you better be ready to use it. I don't care what it is. That's real life, John. That's real. New York is a gray area.
Yeah, but Matsumoto's character, he pulls it and he uses it to a reasonable point. He wasn't supposed to give Douglas's character brain damage. I mean,
I think that's what Conklin was hinting at. Like, why did you stop? You should have beat the hell out of me. One line though, before you guys continue, one line, I don't remember, I'm paraphrasing cause it just popped in my mind, but I think it spoke to how it was a moment where Michael Douglas's character realized that he's a fish out of water and that he is completely unaware of what's going on in this world that he's found himself in, is when Kate Capshaw's character, who I actually liked, I forgot her name. I know he called her Chicago because she's from Chicago.
Joyce.
He asks her, you know, what's going on? She says, well, there's a gang war between this, you know, Suge and so and Sato, whatever she says. And Michael Douglas is like, well, you know, how many people know about this? And she says, including you and me. He's like, yeah. She says, 11 million.
Exactly.
She says 11 million. And he's just like, it was that moment where he realized, motherfucker, this is not a secret. This is not, you know, this is not New York. Yeah. It's not like, you know, this is going on in a back room or whatever. Everybody knows this. You know, I'm not talking to you. You know, no one else here is going to talk to you. You're the only one that doesn't know, you know. And I thought that was a great, great line of dialogue.
I think I'm going to start calling people babe just like that, just for fun and see.
Yeah, you know what? Babe. I mean, real talk. Anytime they called each other babe, it was again, to my point I made earlier about you have to commit yourself as a writer or a storyteller or a filmmaker, or whatever, to the world that you're trying to create. They fully committed themselves because of the first 100% moment of that movie. When Charlie calls Conklin babe, for a second it threw me off and I was like, I laughed, like, why do you call? But then they keep doing it and it's so natural.
Yeah.
And it gets to the point where they're eating noodles in Tokyo and Conklin is trying to figure out if this bill is counterfeit, so he sets it on fire, he messes up Charlie's lunch. And he says, you know, I'll buy you, you know, I owe you lunch. And Charlie's like, forget it, babe. Or whatever he says to him. It's just so natural. It's like, by that point in the movie, I'm like, yeah, that made sense. Yeah. You know, that he's calling another man babe. That made sense. Yeah. You know, there's no problem with that. No, you know, so all jokes aside, it's hilarious to hear you guys say it, especially Arthur, because he sounds like Michael Douglas when he does it. But it worked for the movie.
It did.
My favorite series of dialogue is in the club where Masumoto and Conklin, you know, they clearly have conflict, and Masumoto begins basically just like dressing him down about how superior the Japanese are. It's like, he's basically, you know, we're the creators, you're the consumers, Americans are, I forget the exact line, but he was like, you know, Americans are only good for, you know, like entertainment. Movies and music. Mm-hmm. And Conklin can't say anything about it. He's got nothing to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I liked about that moment was that, well, Conklin does have something to say, because Conklin says, if any of you had an original idea, you so tight you couldn't pull that out of your ass.
Oh, that's when
so
he gets
typical.
Up.
Again, it plays into his characters being, you know, typical, very very American, very Western. But I like that moment because, again, that was when Masumoto said, you know, right after World War II, I knew your soldiers. You had honor then. Mm-hmm. You know, so evidently Matsumoto had an interaction with maybe one or two, maybe more, someone in, that he met, you know, a U.S. soldier, did have honor in his eyes. Mm-hmm. But he's, again, he's doing the same thing as Suke is doing at this point, mm-hmm. looking at the empire as a whole and saying, you create nothing of value, you just consume, and you shove your values down our throats. Mm-hmm. And so it was, again, it was that push and pull.
Yeah.
And I really feel like, again, I really feel like for Conklin, for just a moment, just a glimmer, maybe, he had to accept and learn about honor before he could learn about redemption. And moments of dialogue like that, even though they're very small, I think played into that. And again, the whole conversation between Matsumoto and Conklin during the stakeout was beautiful. That dialogue was excellent.
Yeah.
Good point.
All right.
Shout out to New York as a whole gray area, though. Great line. Great line.
And truthful.
In 1989.
We actually needed an electric guitar riff after like half the lines in this movie.
In 1989, that was a great line. 2021, I don't think you're writing that in a script. I hope you're not.
All right, that's a full lid on season two of Snobs on Film. We thank you for joining and following us and interacting with us over the course of these episodes on Twitter, Snobs on Film.
What's next season's theme?
Yeah, we got to talk about that.
Revenge.
Should we ask the listeners to tell us what they want it to be, or are we not doing that?
Because they'll come up with some blackness.
And we're leaving that in.
Find us online at snobsonfilm.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts. We ask that you leave us a rating and a review. It really does help for show discovery and introduce us to new audience members. And we are found anywhere and everywhere that fine RSS feeds are consumed. See you next season.
Peace.